Thank you, Bill. Our next speaker is Suzanne Mudge, and she's a librarian at the Archives of Traditional Music at Indiana University. In the last few years, she's been heavily involved in the preservation, cataloging, and digitization as the curator of the Hoagie Carmichael Multimedia Collection that was donated to Indiana University. Today, she'll speak about the complexity hidden behind the homespun persona of songwriter and performer Hoagie Carmichael. Suzanne.
Thanks. My talk takes about 33 minutes, so we should make it. Okay, here we go. Oh.
The time.
Here we don't go. Cool. Let's go back to the beginning.
The time I was his only one, but now I'm the sad and lonely one. So lonely was I gay.
Was I gay?
Till today.
Till today.
Now she's gone and we're through, baby. Ooh.
Am I blue? Am I blue?
I wanted to give a talk about Lauren Bacall's singing, but I decided not to. It's a testament to Hoagie Carmichael's versatility as a performer and actor that next to being remembered for Stardust, Georgia, and a handful of other songs, he's most widely recognized from his character roles in movies such as To Have and Have Not with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. The thesis that Hoagie Carmichael, the person, was quite different from the character he portrayed in a dozen movies has been confirmed by others, including Richard Sudhalter, Carmichael's biographer, and as we shall see, Carmichael himself. In his 2002 Carmichael biography, Stardust Melody, Richard Sudhalter writes, quote, "He, Carmichael, appears to have set to work with single-minded determination, shaping the cinematic character henceforth to be known as Hoagie Carmichael. And, quote, he's invented, synthesized a persona, and his name is Hoagie." The goal of this presentation, then, is not to prove this point, but rather to first highlight aspects of Hoagie's character development, and second, demonstrate through media and unpublished personal papers housed at the Archives of Traditional Music at Indiana University ways in which this talented, ambitious man worked behind the scenes to influence the historical account of his work. Finding a voice. Although Carmichael gave up cornet fairly on and felt he was limited in his piano playing style, he successfully interpreted and promoted his music through his own performances throughout his life. Carmichael's first published recording as a vocalist was with Paul Whiteman's orchestra in a 1927 Victor recording of Washboard Blues, his own composition. In the 1920s and early 1930s, Carmichael experimented to not only learn to sing, but also to find his own style and place among singers. In this first audio clip, a very early, unreleased recording on a well-used acetate disc, we hear Hoagie in a crooning style as he explores his upper vocal range. The song is In My Wildest of Dreams by Sammy Kahn and Saul Chaplin, recorded in 1926.
In my wildest of dreams, there was I in a garden. In my wildest of dreams, you were there in my arms. I was filled with a longing to be belonging to you. Make my wildest of dreams come true.
The next two rather extreme examples run together. In the first, Carmichael is singing a novelty number, Harvey, by Peter DeRose and Al Stillman. It was issued in Brunswick in 1929 by Brunswick. The second, Carmichael's well-known Rockin' Chair, was recorded in the early 1930s as a test for Victor, but was never released.
Harvey's a poor boy, but Harvey's a pure boy. The girls all like Harvey, he's such a nice boy. Harvey's a swell boy, he's really a swell fella. The old folks love Harvey, he's their only boy.
But if you could see how he acts when the people all turn their back.
Old rocking chair got me. My cane laying by my side. Fetch me that gin, son, or tan your hide now. Can't get from this cabin, I ain't going nowhere. Just set me here grabbing at the flies round this rocking chair.
Through the years, even after he had established himself as a vocalist, not everyone wanted to hear Hoagie sing. People generally had strong, negative, or positive feelings. It is also interesting that Carmichael kept such correspondence. From an anonymous writer in 1940, I don't want to skip this letter, it's one of my favorites. Dear Hoagie, as a friend, I would like to make a comment about your radio program. Your orchestra is swell, also your girl vocalist. But I'm telling you this truthfully because I know it to be true that you are wrecking your program with your singing. Truthfully, who told you you could sing? You write wonderful songs. I think you should devote all your time to writing these, not singing. So take my advice and stop singing. If you do, you will get a lot more listeners. Please, take my advice. Well, that anonymous person wasn't alone. From Mrs. Thomas Sanborn, or at least on her stationery from 1945, she writes, quote, "I like good music, and your songs are okay when others sing them, but I just can hardly bear to hear you croon. You can't carry a tune. It's lousy, and I have friends that agree with me. Your program is fine when you aren't singing." A listener. Finally, on the other side, there we go. Oops, I really wanted to move there. Here we are. Finally, on the other side, Ted Rosenthal, writing for some reason in behalf of his wife in 1962, says, quote, "We admire you very much as a composer. Stardust, I get along without you very well, and your other ballads are wonderful, but it is as a singer of your own blues-tinged, jazz-rooted songs that you have unconditionally won over my wife as a fan." At age 80, in a 1979 unreleased film documentary produced by Carmichael's son, Hoagie B., Carmichael recounted his ability with phrasing and rhythm and said those skills helped sell his songs. Indeed, whatever one thought of his voice, it could be argued that very few people could sing some of his patter-type songs, such as Hong Kong Blues or The Monkey's Song, as well as he could. In this excerpt of the latter, it is still a work in progress with the working title, Jungleitis.
Well, a monkey heard swing down the woola-wooling. He got bit by the beat of it. Hopped up on the hippo's back with a grin and went into his dance. singing sugity yaggity back. The King Bebop said, "You stop, you ain't exactly on the backbeat. I look at my feet and then he shovel up a rhythm. Got the monkey going with them in a minute. They were borrowing a jack in the sand. So the monkey made a coconut tom-tom, found an old drum that belonged to the voodoos. By the middle of the week, every nanny was speaking about the monkey and his medicine band. He beat the licks with..."
With such songs, Hoagy created, by writing them, a niche for himself, namely storytelling. It would always be a strong element in his style, establishing a persona. So whether or not people wanted to hear Hoagy sing, he was singing and playing piano and composing in a style that began to set him apart, in part because many of his jazz-influenced songs were building on images and stereotypes of the Midwest and South. His songs told stories. Many of the titles were nostalgic, recounting times past. Little Old Lady, Old Man Moon, Old Man Harlem, Poor Old Joe, or Lazy River, Lazy Bones. And people began to see him perform. The next video clip is a composite of short promotional clips from RKO and RMC Productions. Carmichael is still in a suit, but his character has taken shape.
Lazy Bones, sleeping in the sun. How you expect to get your day's work done? You never get your day's work done. Sleeping in the noonday sun. Oh, rocking chair, giddy, giddy, giddy. Judgment day shirt. Chained to my rocking chair.
Sorry to cut that off, but I want to move a little bit faster. It's important to note that most of the songs I've cited so far were written when Carmichael was living in New York City, 1929 to 1935. While songs during this time were of an easygoing, storytelling, and nostalgic nature, Carmichael was moving quickly, meeting influential people and writing more songs than at any other time in his life. It was an exciting, stimulating, and fast-paced time. Several letters and autobiographical musings attest to this, none more explicitly than a circa 1958 letter to Ralph Hancock. Hancock was working with Carmichael on Hoagy's second memoir. The project was later picked up by Stephen Longstreet, published as Sometimes I Wonder, in 1965. Sharing his reflections on New York City in the 1930s, Hoagy writes, quote, "The greatness, the thrill, and the necessity of New York. Sometimes I think to myself today, what if I had never lived in New York? What a great loss. You've hardly lived at all. Let's face it, New York is a great, big, beautiful, exciting place. It is actually the hub of the world, and strangely enough, it has a far greater hold on me than the whole state of Indiana. I think the corner of 50th and Park, where the church is in winter with snow on it, is more beautiful than Brown County, you traitor. You had to have a New York in order to make hit songs." Brown County, for those of you who don't know, is a county near Bloomington in Indiana. He continues, "The trip back to Indianapolis, circa 1930, was foolish, except to rid my mind definitely of ever living in Indiana." Hoagy and his new wife, Ruth Minardi, pictured in the previous slide, moved to Hollywood in 1936. The image of the unhurried, easygoing piano player singer would soon become fixed in movies, beginning in 1937 with a short scene in MGM's Topper, starring Cary Grant and Constance Bennett. Though Hoagy's appearance in the scene is brief, the character Hoagy is complete and ready for widescreen introduction. In this clip featuring Hoagy's Old Man Moon, it is interesting to note the word stardust in the lyrics, a clear reference to Hoagy's song written 10 years earlier. At the end of the scene, not pictured in this clip, Cary Grant says, "Good night, Hoagy," thus completing the visual introduction to the performer and composer of that, by then, famous composition.
My baby, while we're dancing tonight, express the deep.
By the early 1940s, Hoagy had also begun to shape his character over the airwaves through his radio performances. In an early draft of Sometimes I Wonder, he states that the general premise for the CBS Hoagy Carmichael show was his idea. Undoubtedly, he had a hand in this radio announcement for the show. Quote, when the microphones are set up in Hoagie Carmichael's music room of a Saturday evening, more comes out than music. Hoagie, long established as a songwriter, pianist, and singer, is rapidly achieving a reputation as a practicing catch-as-catch-can philosopher. A new Carmichael talent is no longer occasion for much surprise, for Hoagie has a way of doing things well, without apparent effort. Behind the scenes. Carmichael did not tend to talk openly about his work behind the scenes. Most of the interviews we have offer a Hoagie who is in performance mode. One exception is this unusually candid radio interview from 1964. In it, Carmichael discussed aspects of his work, including his performance persona, with Tony Thomas, broadcaster from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Hoagie was 64. Tony Thomas begins.
Hoagie, you're such a relaxed person, so easygoing. One gets the impression that all these talents have been just given to you and that life has been no problem, no hard work. That can't be the case.
That cannot be the case. It takes a lot of hard work and effort to even to become a songwriter. You have to write a lot of tunes before you find a good one. You speak of me as being relaxed. Actually, I've never been in my life. I've always been an eager beaver, running to get this accomplished, running to get that accomplished. On the stage, I am a relaxed character, but I portray that, and it's been successful. For someone like me to come out and try to knock people over the head with my tunes, no. It's better for them to sit back and be as relaxed as I and just listen, and if they like it, okay. If they don't, okay.
Work hard he did. As a composer, Carmichael did not easily give up on songs he believed had merit. And despite his love for New York and Hollywood, he did not hesitate to turn to his friends back in Indiana to help salvage a song. The following three excerpts offer some insight into Carmichael's compositional process, his tenacity, and his belief in his own work. The story begins with a composition, One Night in Havana. In a 1933 letter to someone identified only as Tom, Carmichael writes, quote, after graduating from school, I went to Florida to practice law. Before leaving Florida, I made a trip to Cuba, and the music I heard down there inspired me to write One Night in Havana. This tune had lots of merit at that time. It was one of the first attempts at rumba in this country, but the tune got kicked around something awful. The earliest version, instrumental only, of One Night in Havana, released in 1927, is noteworthy simply because it was on the A side of the first Jeanette issue of Stardust. The version I'm going to play is a 1929 test pressing recorded for Victor by Carmichael and his orchestra with Frank Salvano on vocals. It was not issued. On the label displayed here, Carmichael wrote, quote, this is my original interpretation of the scene in Havana as I saw it in 1926. Almost a rumba, but not quite. The song received little attention. In 1934, determined Carmichael transformed One Night in Havana to In the Churchyard, also very obscure. In fact, the only audio version we have is a Victor release translated to Spanish as Cementerio de Parroquia, performed by a popular Mexican singer, Juan Arbizu. At this stage, it may sound familiar to anyone who has spent time at Indiana University. Cementerio will segue into a final example. So, first One Night in Havana, with instrumental intro skipping to the vocal chorus, then Cementerio, then one more example.
One girl in all Havana, star-eyed, cute, and belle.
pretty sad.
Sing these chimes of Indiana, hail to the crimson hue. Sing her praise to Gloriana, hail to our old IU. Lift your voices, join in royal chorus. Let from us rejoice in praise of those before.
Chimes of Indiana, music and lyrics by Hoagie Carmichael, was performed by the Singing Hoosiers, a well-known ensemble at IU. Rumba, perhaps, song of mourning, school fight song. While the song illustrates Carmichael's determination, it really never got recognition for Carmichael in any of its versions, although it's still performed at IU as Chimes of Indiana. I doubt if very many people know the composer's name. Similarly, Carmichael was very involved, not easygoing in the collaborative process with lyricists, as with many of the lyric sheets we have at the archives. In this example of Small Fry, with lyrics attributed to Frank Lesser, Hoagie's handwriting is all over the page. As he wrote to Ralph Hancock in the previously cited letter, quote, "I think we've already discussed the fact that my production could have been much greater if my conduct with collaborators had been much more congenial and leave it to you-ish. This I am not too regretful of, because I'm pretty confident that I got perfection out of them for the songs we did finish, even though, on the other hand, they wrote fewer songs with me than they might have otherwise. Undoubtedly, they would have seen the imperfections and honored them themselves at their leisure. But here again, my anxiety for perfection led me sometimes into an awkward and indelicate situation. I was quick with the notes and expected the other fellow to be quick with the words." As would be expected of celebrity status, Carmichael received a great deal of mail, from solicitations, especially from aspiring lyricists, to critiques and advice, as we've seen. Hoagie built on people's general interest in the compositional process by publicly recounting stories of various songs' origins and by reenacting the stories on radio and television. No song received more attention than Stardust, and this was true about the various stories of its inception. A lesser-known example is the story behind the search for the lyricist for "I Get Along Without You Very Well." Carmichael had found a poem in a 1922 Life magazine with the initials JB. After putting music to the words, for which he added extensive revisions, he wanted to credit the lyricist for ethical and legal reasons. In the standard account, Carmichael and the famous Music Corporation publishers searched the country for the lyricist and finally enlisted the help of Walter Winchell, famed radio broadcaster. They find JB, one Jane Thompson Brown, but she dies right before Dick Powell's radio debut of the song. Here, then, is a short clip from the 1957 Telephone Time reenactment with Carmichael and Winchell playing themselves.
Hoagie, come on in. What's your trouble?
How did you know?
What else?
I am in a jam.
What kind of a jam?
It seems that I'm looking for a lyric writer.
A lyric writer? Now, who do you want me to call? Just name him. Just name him.
You don't understand. I have the lyric, but I do not have the lyric writer.
What kind of double talk is that?
I know it sounds like...
You... Now, give it to me slowly. You have the lyrics, but you haven't the lyric writing.
It's like this. 10 years ago, I was playing the piano in the sorority house back in Indiana.
Think, Hoagie, think.
What do you think I've been doing?
Concentrate, Hoagie.
Hey, what time is it?
9:05.
Turn on the radio, please. I want to hear Winchell.
We're in the soup, and he wants to listen to Winchell.
And so, if you can fill out the rest of the words after the first line, "I get along without you very well," there's a surprise for you. If you wrote it, or you know who wrote it, contact the famous Music Corporation.
Perhaps the most striking area where Carmichael worked to retrospectively establish his stories was on the physical items themselves, particularly his recordings, music, and photographs. Although I cannot say precisely when he annotated the following examples, most documents with dates are from the 1950s. I've already displayed one example from One Night in Havana. I should note Carmichael's written assertion in at least a half dozen other places that it was the first example of a rumba, or almost a rumba, in this country. On another test pressing, he writes, "Pretty bad, but the last quarter inch of this record proves that I was the first to record rumba in this country, 1928. He's pretty stubborn about that. And this example is one of many where Carmichael documents a story, since they vary, about the composition of Stardust. In this photo, he signs his name, notes the address of the house, and states, quote, where Stardust was written, with an arrow up to the door, then, in the left margin, on an old beat-up grand behind that door. On the reverse, he also notes that he is writing with a pen George Gershwin gave him. Here's an example of one of his music manuscripts, in this case, Washboard Blues, where he writes, quote, this is the original solo piano arrangement that was later incorporated into the recordings of Washboard Blues, and from which I got the musical ideas for Lazy Bones, signed Hoagie Carmichael. Many examples of recordings include evaluations of the performances and their significance to his work in general. Refashioning. It should be remembered that at this time, mid to late 1950s, Carmichael had begun work on his second memoir. It appeared to be a period of both self-reflection and a time when he tried to refashion himself. In 1949, he had written a classical composition, a tone poem entitled Brown County Autumn. It received dismal reviews after the Carnegie Hall performance in early 1950. By the mid-1950s, the general public may well have thought Hoagie was ready for retirement. Whether or not the publishers were buying, he was still writing songs, and with his son's help, was trying to keep up with the times, to continue to find new venues for his music. He wanted to stay in the public eye. With Nacio Brown Jr. as his agent, Hoagie continued to experiment and record demonstration discs from the 1950s to the 1960s. In the next example, probably from the early 1950s, Hoagie is whistling in a duet with an unidentified flute player. Tried a country style approach.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds, because you're mine. I walk the line.
Johnny Cash looked a little skeptical, and the public wasn't buying it either. In the early 60s, he had started working on a Western series, Laramie, and even served as the voice for his animated character in The Flintstones. He'd begun writing children's songs in 1957, and in 1970, at the urging of his son, Hoagie B., worked on a WGBH Boston television show for children, Hoagie Carmichael's Music Shop. Even with vibraphonist Monty Stark and his fellow jazz rock musicians, including John Abercrombie, providing the arrangements, it was cut after a season. In this clip, Hoagie is teaching the children the chromatic scale using his song, Rocket Ship, as an illustration. Get the idea. Despite the earlier failure of Brown County, in the early 1960s, Hoagie began work on a second classical composition, the Johnny Appleseed Suite, based on the story of John Chapman. It's difficult to tell anything from a short clip, but here he is, while it is still very much a work in progress, playing the last movement that he describes briefly beforehand. It's called Fulfillment Music.
This is the Fulfillment Music, and it starts with his prayer. Now he's coming back to see all of his apple trees and see what he's done in his life. Fulfillment.
Fulfillment.
can't help but wonder who he's talking about, looking back on his own life, perhaps. Although a portion of the work was performed on the Bell Telephone Hour, the piece was never performed in its entirety. Carmichael finally donated the open whistling theme to the NFL as Little Pearl Marching Song. Now, I've probably only got about 3 minutes left, so just to give you an idea where I am. Again, despite these efforts to refashion himself, there was no sustained momentum. By the 1960s, Hoagie had a reputation of being somewhat difficult to work with, of wanting bigger roles, and even trying to rewrite parts for himself. More importantly, the 1960s, as we saw last night, were not a time for nostalgia or pastoral reflection. Johnny Appleseed's story was simply not compelling in comparison to the offerings of the Beatles and other rock musicians of the 1960s. I would argue that Hoagie was trapped in the persona he had worked so hard to create over three decades earlier. The 1960s were not the decade for this easygoing, philosophical piano player. I'll let him speak for himself again in another short excerpt from the 1964 Tony Thomas interview. Thomas begins by asking, "Are you still putting in time at the piano at home composing songs?"
"I bet you I have 25 songs lying in my trunk. They're new ones that I've written in the last 5 or 6 years.
"Well, now, I haven't heard a new Hoagie Carmichael song in a long, long time. Now, are you not putting them on the market?"
No, it isn't quite that, Tony. You know, the demand on records for music has not been particularly my type music. It's been music that the younger set like, you know, twist and rock and roll, and I just never put my time at writing those type numbers.
In the 1970s, Carmichael spent much of his last decade being toasted at birthday celebrations, receiving honors from a wide range of organizations, and as a guest celebrity on specials television. He used his considerable creative energy to paint, amass an impressive coin collection, and create an unusual assortment of inventions, including an egg cooker and a new type of golf. Though his cinematic character was out of step, Hoagie told his stories until the end. In this unedited clip from The Stardust Road, the documentary filmed 2 years before his death, he recounts a story cited in many places, ever conscious of his on and off camera personality.
"But about Johnny coming over to the house to write a song. Ready? Okay?
Okay.
So some months later, Johnny Mercer came over to my house. I was half asleep in the chair in my apartment. He knocked on the door, and I didn't want to see anybody. I was too tired. But I said, 'Come in,' and he came in. I said, 'Hi, John.' 'Hello, Hoag.' I said, 'What do you want?' He said, 'I want to write a song.' I said, 'Well, I don't know.' 'Okay, let's see what we can do. What's the title of the song you want to write?' Imagine what he said. 'Lazy Bones.'"
Ironically, perhaps, I think there would have been a continuing place for Hoagie Carmichael where he started, in jazz, if he'd continued to pursue it. Today, his songs are still highly respected and played by more jazz musicians than perhaps any other group. It is also ironic that some of his songs, for example, Lazy River and Heart and Soul, have been orally transmitted by many people, including children, who are unaware that they were composed, let alone by Carmichael. Hoagie has his own philosophical conclusions regarding his contributions, of course, so I'll let him have the last word.
"Myself and what I've contributed to the world in the form of entertainment and music, I'm very pleased and I'm kind of proud of myself. I admit that. But I don't and never have carried a little American flag around and letting people see me and telling them how great I am. I've never done that. I've seen some people do that. But I've never done that. I've never been actually a day-to-day conscious of the fact that I am somebody important. It doesn't enter my mind. I just go about my business. Now you go about your business. And thank you for listening."
Thanks for listening. Thanks for staying.
Thank you. I encourage you to seek out the presenters and ask questions when you can. Right now, we are out of time, and with the bus schedule, thank you all for coming. It was a nice session. Thank you.